Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Dear bhaiyo, beno aur buzruko, how's it? Well, as you all were told by my stand-ins over the past 3 weeks, Mustafa Darsot and Aslam Ayat, I was suffering from a killer flu, the whole works, the full catastrophe, eh? Non-stop coughing and sneezing, and of course the 24-hour snot factory. 2 dozen Kleenex boxes, klar, and 10 bottles of, cough mixture, Benelin. Whacked it, 10 bottles, I think. Yes, of course, many of you made dua for me, jazakallah khair for that. But you know what? You know what made me instantly better? That's right, my flu disappeared immediately. How did that happen? Well, it was as I was walking past the kitchen and saw my fro stirring a big pot of kheer. Yes, sir. The fever, coughing and sneezing disappeared instantly. Instantly. Yes, folks, I'm back to normal, alhamdulillah. Don't feel sick anymore. Speaking about sick, well, the news came out this week about the sick society that we are living in. Really sick. Crime statistics released this week indicate that on average, 58 murders occur every day. Did you hear that? Every day in South Africa. 58 murders every day. Over the past year, 21,000 people were killed in our country. 21,000. That's more than the number of people killed in Yemen over the past year. And Yemen is a war zone. Well, South Africa is at war with itself. We are living in a nightmare. 58 murders every day. Good heavens. And over the past couple of weeks, the focus has been on gender-based violence. Violence against women. It's sick. It's despicable. A young woman is attacked inside a post office and her head is smashed, crushed with a scale. The monster who did this shouldn't be hanged. That would be too quick. He should be given a slow, painful death. And I have some ideas about that, which includes red-hot braai skewers and some razor blades. But let me not get too carried away. Now, here's a shock statistic. In sunny South Africa, a woman gets raped every 36 seconds. Did you get that? Every 36 seconds. We are a sick society, people. Sick society. No one seems to have the answer to this madness. Women are the most vulnerable sector of our society, but there are all kinds of rats crawling out there that are ready to pounce on them as if they have the right to do so. Makes me so cross, I tell you. Very cross indeed. But let me change gears a little, but still stick with the subject of women abuse. Now this, what is about to follow, is a real horror story. I was shocked when I read it. It was reported widely in the international media, and it's about a Muslim woman. She and her husband, they live in the United Arab Emirates. The woman wants to be divorced from her husband because, in her words, she endured a year of hell. That's right, they were married only for a year. And she says that she endured a year of hell. That's her words. Her story is horrific. I'm not sure I should give you details of what she had to suffer. Please, please. Sensitive listeners, please switch off right now. Okay, let me read to you from the article published in many newspapers, including the UAE's Khalij Times. This is what it says. The woman filed for divorce at the Sharia court in Fujairah, which is in the United Arab Emirates, complaining that she, and these are her actual words, was choked by his extreme love and affection. The husband was so kind, he even went on a strict diet and exercise regime that left him with a broken leg when she told him off for gaining weight. But this did not please the angry wife, who told the court, "I am eagerly longing for a single day of dispute, but this seems impossible with my romantic husband, who always forgave me and showered me with daily gifts." The wife had complained to the court that her spouse never argued or yelled at her and was always kind. But this cruel-free treatment left her wanting more. She says, "I need a real discussion, even an argument, not this hassle-free life of full obedience. I am choked by his extreme love and affection. He even assisted me in cleaning the house without me asking him." Even her application for a divorce did not stem the affections of her doting husband. Can you believe that? Even when she wanted a divorce, he still said, he begged the courts to reject it. According to the English language UAE newspaper Khalij Times, he told the court, "It's not fair to judge a marriage from the first year, and everybody learns from their mistakes. I am and always wish to be a perfect and kind husband." The court ordered an adjournment of the case to give the couple a chance to settle the dispute. Yes, sir, say, did you get that? The woman was really suffering. She just couldn't take it anymore. He was kind, considerate, helpful, no arguments. He cleaned the house, gave her gifts, and when she called him a fat lump, he immediately went out and started full swing exercising, which resulted in him breaking a leg. Don't you think this is a crazy story? The woman is fed up because her husband is so good to her. You know which part I like? Where the husband says to the judge, "Please, sir, it's not fair to judge a marriage from the first year. Everybody learns from their mistakes." So what does that mean, dear listeners? That he's going to change. He says he made a mistake by being so good to her, and he'll try better not to be so good to her. So what does that mean? That he's going to change. He's not going to be so good anymore. That's what he's trying to say. He will try hard to be bad. Maybe he will argue with her. Maybe toss his dirty socks all over the lounge. Don't put the cap back on the toothpaste. Burp loudly. And maybe eat with his mouth open. Forget to flush the toilet. Insult her parents. Tell her loudly in a crowded restaurant, "Shut up, don't talk nonsense." Tell her that she can't cook like his mother. Buy an electric frying pan for her birthday, or even forget her birthday completely. I think that's better. You know what? Maybe I should send him all these suggestions, these ideas to save his marriage. Poor fellow needs help so badly. Now, all those ladies out there, put up your hands, please. Just put up your hands if you would like your husband to be like this fellow. Put up your hands. Whoa, I can see hands right up here from Durban to Polokwane. Well, there you are, folks. The lady says that her one-year marriage was a life of hell. First-class nutcase. And speaking about nutcases, did you hear the former head of the SABC, Claudie Motsoeneng, giving evidence at the Zondo Commission? He reminds me of a popular expression. It is better to remain silent and be thought of as being a fool than to speak and remove all doubt. It's better not to say anything, and people may think that you're a fool, than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. Claudie says that he didn't need a matric to get the top job at the SABC. Well, all I can say is that this Ullu has a PhD in Mamparanas. Yeah, PhD, Doctor of Mamparanas. Some of the things he said are, listen to this. He said, I lectured at universities, even at Wits Business School. I lectured, and my lectures about my leadership, they have turned them as part of my syllabus. And the university said, no, Claudie, you didn't lecture here. And he says about him being the main man, if they advertise the job, Chairperson, don't you think they would get someone who is better than Claudie? I can tell you, in the SABC, no one was better than me, even if they advertised it. I train doctors at SABC. I train lawyers. I ask, what do you know? Theory? People know theory. Two kinds of people. This is what he says. You have two kinds of people in the world. You have certificated people and educated people. You can have many degrees, but also in that you need brain. You can have many degrees, but also in that you need brain. Now, about educated people, he says, all that many educated people know how to do is to read the whole day. They don't have time to think about unity. I have been thinking maybe our employees should have uniforms so they can understand unity. And about encouraging crime. If you always put crime on media, you report about crime, actually what you're doing, you are encouraging young people to commit crime. Oh my God. The logic of that one, I tell you. Right. Some leaders are born. This is what he says. Some leaders are born. I, like myself, I am a born leader. So you can't take that away from me. I have been leading from a young age. From standard 3, I was a leader. Even leading my own teachers. And training doctors and lawyers. Oh no, we did that one. Running South Africa. I know how to run South Africa, man. I have managed a billion-rand company. I don't need to be a counselor. I need to be a person taking decisions. Corruption. Maybe I should accept that I am corrupt. And I'm accepting it. I am corrupt. My corruption is the good one. Because it is turning around the lives of the people of South Africa. That is my corruption. About madness. Multi-choice CEO told me I was mad. But it was good madness. The Guptas. We would fly to all these provinces with the Guptas, even to Cape Town, because we were in partnership and we had everything. For me, it was an opportunity to also capture them. We used to enjoy curry with them. He's going to capture the Guptas. And Claudie, the public figure, he says, everywhere I go around the world, people acknowledge Claudie. And I like this one, the one and only. In my view, Claudie Motsoeneng is Claudie Motsoeneng, and there is one Claudie Motsoeneng in South Africa. Is this one called Claudie Motsoeneng? let me repeat that, the last one. There is only one Claudie Motsoeneng in South Africa. Okay, South Africa, all together now, say, thank God for that. Amazing, isn't it? This guy was the head of the SABC. You know what? It must never happen again. We learned our lesson. It must never happen again that we get such a clown to head anything. I hope we learned our sabak. How do you spell sabak? S-A-B-C. Sabak. That's a clever one, isn't it? And still on the subject of women's issues, people want to do all kinds of things to level the playing fields. And that's correct. We should level the playing fields. So people are doing all kinds of things to show that there is equality between men and women, or even go further and give preference to women because they have been discriminated against for far too long, especially in the workplace. And that was one of the reasons for the march on Friday to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Well, sometimes an effort to lift women can be quite silly. What was it I said? Leveling the playing fields. Leveling the playing fields. Some of you may remember what we used to play back before computers and cell phones. When you went on holiday to the Berg or a cottage, you got a cottage in the Eastern Transvaal, the whole family, cousins and all went up there. One of the popular games in the evening was Monopoly. Remember that? Lots of fun, lots of cheating also. Well, to make women feel better, the company that makes the board game came out with a new version of the game. And to be politically correct, it's called Ms. Monopoly, Ms. Monopoly. Listen to this. In the latest update of the classic board game Monopoly, unveiled on Tuesday, the trademark real estate tycoon has been replaced by his socially minded niece. You remember, we used to have that tycoon buying all the properties and all that on Monopoly. Well, now they've got something called a socially minded niece, an advocate who invests in female entrepreneurs. In Ms. Monopoly, players collect inventions made by women, such as Wi-Fi and solar heating. Female players start out with more money than males and receive $240 each time they pass Go, more than the $200 that goes to males. That's an inversion on real life, where women make only 81% of what men do, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. The game box shows a bright-eyed Ms. Monopoly carrying a cup of coffee and announces itself as the first game where women make more than men. Hasbro, which is the company that produces Monopoly, said in a news release, "The pay disparity," this is its own words, "is a fun spin in the game that creates a world where women have an advantage, often enjoyed by men. However, if men play their cards right, they can make more money too." The game will be available from mid-September in the U.S. as well as in a range of other countries, including France, Germany, Canada, Australia, and Malaysia. That's it. The new Ms. Monopoly, where women are given an advantage. $40 more if you pass Go. I mean, really, really. If I was a woman, I would feel very insulted. I would want a level playing field, not a lopsided one. And now the old game where you collect houses and hotels is no more. You now collect Wi-Fi and solar heating made by women. What a load of bull. Let's move on. It's the big funeral of Robert Mugabe today. And in the media, we hear that there are two attitudes to his death. One is where people mourn him as a great liberator who freed Zimbabwe from white colonialist rule. The other, that he was a ruthless dictator who destroyed Zimbabwe. So, what's my view? Well, yes, he did bring freedom to Zimbabwe. And yes, he was a ruthless dictator. So which one do we go for? Now, a top surgeon takes out a gun and shoots a man who, let's say, swore at him for some reason. The man is dead. The surgeon is taken to court. He tells the judge, "Sir, I am a surgeon and I saved 5,000 lives over the past 10 years and I only took one life. So I think you should let me go." You see what I mean? Yes, Mugabe freed Zimbabwe from tyranny. Wonderful. And then he became a tyrant himself. Between 1983 and 1987, Mugabe launched the so-called Gukura Hundi, which was a violent campaign targeting civilians and alleged dissidents who supported the Zimbabwe African People's Union, that is ZAPU, and its leader, Joshua Nkomo. The Korean-trained 5th Brigade, an army unit with political links that fell outside army command, killed an estimated 20,000 people in Matabele land and the Midland provinces. Did you hear that? 20,000 people killed in Matabele land. And people still want to recognize and celebrate him as a hero? Ask their relatives of people, of the 20,000, what they think. Zimbabwe is a wasteland. Its currency is in the toilet. Its medical facilities, well, let me put it this way. Mugabe died in a hospital in Singapore. That says it all. Someone said Zimbabwe is now one bob shy. And I say, good for you, Zimbabwe. Right, let's get to more serious issues. I think we'll just go for a quick break and get to the serious issues after that. To the big picture. And before the break, I told you that we're going to discuss some serious issues. Now, during this past week, there were two very important anniversaries. Very, very important anniversaries of two big lies. Did you get that? That's right. Two big lies. One event happened 18 years ago on September 11th, and the other happened 26 years ago on September 13th. Two big lies that resulted in great injustice and suffering. So let's get to it. On the morning of September 11, 2001, the Twin Towers in New York came down. We were told that some Saudi guys hijacked planes and crashed them into the Twin Towers. And that gave birth to what was called the War on Terror. Afghanistan was first, and then Iraq was destroyed. And Muslims were targeted all over the world. Islamophobia went into overdrive. All this based on the big lie that terrorists attacked the Twin Towers. Let's unpack that. And to help us, we have the man who knows everything. And that, of course, is Mustafa Darsot. Mustafa, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the big picture.
Walaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. AB man, don't put me in the spotlight and know everything. It's only by the grace of Allah Ta'ala we know things.
Anyway, Ameen.
Assalamualaikum to all the listeners. AB, I've been following 9/11, of course, like you, since the day it happened, with the close scrutiny and, you know, the aftermath, the narratives, etc., and came across various aspects that have been deliberately omitted from the mainstream media narratives. For the simple reason they had to tie in with the official policy that came out from the U.S. government and the spin. And as what you rightfully said, that it resulted in the so-called war on terror, and majority of the lives that have been lost have been Muslims, and Islamophobia gone into overdrive. And, you know, looking at the few aspects that have come to light only now, you know, almost 18 years later, and now it's very easy for, you know, for even if the mainstream media has to come out with it, that this is what came out, because the damage has been done, and severe damage. Look, for example, the people that were involved in the actual 9/11, the role players. To my understanding, there were four major role players. One was Dick Cheney, the former U.S. Vice President. Two was Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York. Three were the Israelis. And four was Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, who was the former ambassador to the United States. They were involved in the, well, one can say the mastermind, the actual unfolding of the event, and the aftermath and the cover-up. Okay, what has surfaced as well is that generally the Twin Towers have been a massive complex and housing thousands of workers, yet the official death toll has been just around 3,000, and that's pretty strange, given that it was during work hours, and, you know, you would expect, you know, the death toll to be higher, although people had a chance, whoever was lucky to escape. And it turns out so that the 9/11 of that day in September 2001 was coinciding with a Jewish holiday. In all probabilities was Rosh Hashanah, and that can explain why there were not many workers at work. Then you had the incident of the high-fivers dancing Israelis. Okay, now there was a lot of that going around, and it was, you know, it debunked as conspiracy theory. And just this year, the FBI has released a report, and this was around in May this year, that they released a report whereby they are, you know, that the dancing Israelis have come under fresh scrutiny, because they found that two of the five were Mossad agents who had prior knowledge of 9/11. In fact, one of the guys, his name was Sivan Kurtzberg, he was found scouting the area the day before on 10 September 2001. And there's, you know, and these are the things the FBI is pursuing. Now, what happened with them was that on 9/11 at about 8:46 a.m., the first tower was struck, right? And then a few minutes later, these five Israelis were seen in a parking lot of an apartment building across the Hudson River in the state of New Jersey, celebrating, dancing, taking pictures, videos, hitting high fives. And obviously, you know, concerned people, you know, alerted the police and they were arrested. And this guy, Sivan Kurzberg, told the cops that, listen, we Israelis are not your problem. Your problem is our problem. The Palestinians are the problem. So you can see that the where this all leads to, and why would there have been such a cover-up for 18 years? That even if now that this has, if they, with the FBI pursuing it, one has to ask the question: what will actually happen? Will there be any action taken place, etc.? Then you have the problem about the leaseholder of the building, who is Larry Silverstein, who is now 89 years old, retired, sitting with his big fat insurance payouts. Now, Larry Silverstein was a property developer, property mogul, who signed a 99-year lease in July 2001. That was approximately just two months plus before the attacks. And he took out massive insurance over the towers, over four buildings out of the complex of seven. And he insured he took out terrorism cover for $3.2 billion. Right? Mm. And it only emerged in 2008 when he was suing the insurance companies for $12.3 billion for damages that he suffered, right? That he was already paid $4.6 billion by the insurance company. It's about, say, $1.4 billion more than what he was insured, right? Mm. And this again raises very serious question marks, because shortly after 9/11, it was revealed that he was called as the leaseholder of the building to say, listen, that the fire has gone out of hand in WTC7, which is a 47-story building, and we need to know what to do. And he says, pull it. In other words, plug it, let it demolish, pull it down. And this was 9 hours later, and we were told the nonsense that the building got weakened because of the two towers that had fallen. And that's why it was on fire, and that's why suddenly, 9 hours later, this building fell. But what's also interesting, when you go through Larry Silverstein's portfolio, you'll find that his partner is another notorious character called Frank Louie, who is also 89 years old. Now, Frank Louie, he was a Slovakian-Hungarian Jew, right, that emigrated to Australia and set up his business there, and he grew into a massive empire that spanned across North America, Australia, and other parts of the world. And, you know, he sold up his shares in the company, although he still holds a seat in the board. But his company was known as Westfield Corporation, right? And Westfield Corporation, for those who don't know, owned most of the shopping malls in America, Canada, and Australia. And right here in Africa, these two culprits owned a shopping mall called the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. Now, for those who don't know, 6 years ago in September 2013, Westgate Mall came under attack by four Al-Shabaab terrorists. And it was a weekend where the people were under siege, etc., and a lot of people know what happened thereafter. So, you know, you try and tie in the pattern with these two notorious characters, and you'll find that they are linked to some sort of trouble of a major scale. And it's no coincidence that Frank Louie is now retired, living in Israel. Okay. Then you have Dick Cheney, the former U.S. vice president, who had to rush to an underground bunker on the morning of 9/11, right? And he was seen in his... There's photographs going around of him in his office. In fact, these pictures are on the New Yorker magazine website, whereby he's sitting in this office with his legs on the desk, watching Fox News, where he's seen the Tower One was under attack, right? Like no care in the world, and being alerted by his military chiefs and generals to say that we need to act right away because there's another plane that went off course headed to the same area and we need to intercept. And Dick Cheney's response was, well, let's wait and see. And the thing is that, you know, for the mainstream media to ignore these things is very serious. And not only the mainstream media, for the authorities to ignore these things, because if anybody who was sitting, a sane person sitting in the shoes of Dick Cheney at that time, would have straight away said, hey, what's going on here? We need to mobilize, get whatever resources at this disposal and bring this thing to a stop. George Bush at the time, he wasn't doing anything because he was seen visiting a kindergarten in Florida. And again, that's also popular visuals of him being informed by one of his Secret Service people, this is what's happening, and he looked like stoned or dazed at the news. And then you have the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth Foundation, which is about 3,000 strong, 3,000 plus strong. Now, the reason why they're pursuing this and they want the truth on 9/11 because it puts their careers and reputations in jeopardy, right? They're saying that, look, hold on a minute, whatever happened on 9/11 is a lie, and we want the truth for the simple reason is that because of, if this is going to be the case, it's going to look like we are responsible for shoddy workmanship, right? For and that we, you know, and if anything, then we are going to, you know, we have to face the consequences and the lawsuits. So they are very upset about it, and they've been pursuing this for a good number of years. And it's been found that they have already come to the conclusion that the Twin Towers came down in free fall, and that the WTC-7 building, which Larry Silverstein said 9 hours later conveniently pulled it, didn't come down because of any cause of fire. It was actually, again, through controlled demolition. So these are what we have as far as the stuff that has been escaping the mainstream news. Oh, yes, just for the listeners to know that in the AB, you were the host to Brother Enver Masood from Washington, D.C., who's an electrical engineer, who wrote the book, The War on Islam, and he came out with the, and he found that what it was very strange what happened on 9/11 because he was focusing his attention on the Pentagon, and said that it's impossible what the damage and the scale of damage for a plane to go have crashed into the Pentagon. And what has been resulting was that all the camera and CCTV footage in the vicinity of the Pentagon were immediately confiscated by authorities when that attack happened. And one will raise the question, why? So these are the sort of stuff that have been escaping the mainstream media narrative or the official story on 9/11, and as you said, it's resulted, it's the biggest lie, and it's of course resulted in many unnecessary deaths and loss of life, and brought Islamophobia to a grand scale. Now, what's also very interesting to know is that Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, who was the former U.S. ambassador, he was the longest serving ambassador to America for 22 years. Then in 2005, he went back to Saudi Arabia and he served in the Intelligence Bureau, which is equivalent of the CIA, for another 10 years. And he has been also complicit in this as well. Now, although we, it's hard to accept that 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, but the cover-up and the spin, because if one recalls that for 3 days, all airports in the USA were grounded the moment the Twin Towers were attacked, right? Yet, certain Saudi officials and members of the Bin Laden family, too, were given the green light to fly out of America, you know, under special permission. And who was instrumental in making this happen was Prince Bandar. So he's very much part of the equation. In fact, if anybody wants to come across any articles regarding what I just spoke about now, can go onto my Facebook page under my name, Mustafa Darsot, or follow me on Twitter, at MM Darsot is my Twitter handle, and you'll see and read these articles. And I'm sure that all the listeners out there have asking the same questions.
And there was a small issue of, I think it was Muhammad Al-Attar, who was supposed to be the ringleader of these so-called terrorists.
Yeah.
And he very conveniently, shame, he forgot his copy of the Quran in the pub where he went to have a stiff drink.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it just
there was also the question of
after the airport, they also had copies of Quran, incidentally.
Yeah, and also, you know, when the Twin Towers came down, both buildings were totally destroyed, but shame. The passports of the so-called hijackers were indestructible, and they were found almost immediately, so they got the names from those passports.
Yeah, and then also the same passport, I mean, the same indestructible passports were found in Paris also after the Charlie Hebdo shootings, you know.
Mm.
It seems that we must get those passports so that we don't lose them, you know.
Right, so there you have an analysis from Mustafa Darsot about the big lie, and that was the collapse of the Twin Towers. Mustafa, jazakallah khair for your input.
Okay, be most welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So there you have it, folks, the big lie exposed. The Twin Towers. Now here's the punchline. The man who is described as the mastermind of the attack, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was arrested 17 years ago, yet he hasn't been brought to trial. Why? He's been in Guantanamo Bay all this time. Why hasn't he been brought to trial? Because the only thing they have on him is a so-called confession. And the problem is that this so-called confession was obtained under torture. That's the word, torture. He was waterboarded 183 times. You know what is waterboarding? They put you on like a seesaw, right? They tie you up to a plank, and then your head is lowered right down, and your feet are up on the seesaw. And then they cover your face with a cloth, and they pour water onto your face, onto the cloth. And you feel like you are suffocating, you are drowning, you are about to die. Can you imagine that feeling? You can't breathe. And this was done 183 times to him. He came almost close to feeling that he was dying. You know the gabrats you can get from that. You can get a heart attack. So any confession obtained under torture is inadmissible in a court of law. So the so-called mastermind of the attack has waited and waited and waited for 17 years to be brought to trial. Right, now to the next big anniversary that I told you about, the big lie. 18 years ago, on the 13th of September, which was yesterday, of course, on the lawns of the White House, Yasser Arafat, for the Palestinians, and Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, signed a peace deal. What was it about? And I spoke to you about this many times before. But let's go back a bit. In 1948, Jewish forces, Zionist forces, spread out all over what was then known as Palestine and captured 78% of that land of Palestine, including half of Jerusalem, West Jerusalem it's called. This area was then declared to be Israel. 78% of historic Palestine was declared to be Israel. The parts that were not captured, that's Gaza, half of Jerusalem where Al-Aqsa is located, and the West Bank made up of 22%. All of this, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem made up 22%, and these areas were controlled by Egypt and Jordan. Then in 1967, Israel captured this 22%. Yasser Arafat and his PLO were like the ANC, they were outside of the country in Tunisia, and they were fighting to free the whole of Palestine. But they became weaker and weaker, and 18 years ago, a deal was put on the table, and they signed the so-called peace deal with Israel, all done there on the lawns of the White House. Basically, the understanding was that Arafat will give up the armed struggle and come back home to Ramallah in the West Bank, take control of a few small towns, and then negotiations will continue about giving the Palestinians their own independent state over the 22%. So that's what they thought, they would get that 22%, Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem. That was a dirty, rotten, stinking lie. And I said this right from the start, that it was a con. It was a big lie. Since the peace deal was signed 18 years ago, Israel has annexed East Jerusalem, where Al-Aqsa is located, and gobbled up about, well, with the municipal boundaries, about 40% of the West Bank by building huge settlements, which are, of course, housing estates all over the West Bank. If you've been there, you know what I'm speaking about. And here's the punchline. Netanyahu announced that after the Israeli election, he just announced this recently, that after the Israeli elections next week, I think it's on the 17th, if he is elected as Prime Minister once again, he will annex, meaning that he will make it part of Israel, the Jordan Valley. This is part of the West Bank. The Jordan Valley. This is the land all along the border with Jordan. It is rich, fertile land and has a great deal of water. And it makes up one third of the West Bank. Are you still with me? One third of the West Bank. So, bottom line. The Palestinians compromised and said, okay, just give us 22% of our original Palestine as our state. We will make our state on that 22%. They got nothing for 18 years, and now one-third of that 22%, one-third of that 22, or one-third of the West Bank will go to Israel. Not even 22, one-third of that whole of the West Bank will go to Israel. And also all the settlements in the West Bank will become part of Israel. So what will the Palestinians get? Well, they'll get bits and pieces like Bapu Tswana, surrounded by the Israeli military, and of course, all over the West Bank, you have the settlement. And of course, Gaza is under siege. That is the wonderful peace deal that was signed between Palestinians and Israel 18 years ago. Call it what it is. Apartheid. Finish and clear. That's what it is. Apartheid. After the big lie of 9/11, huge suffering and injustice. After the big lie of the so-called peace deal, huge suffering and injustice. So that's where we're going to leave it. That's where we're going to leave it for now, because after the 12 o'clock news, we are going to be joining or continuing the program on Al Ansar. And don't forget to join me also on the trips that I have in December. Maja is the word. What's the word? Maja. You got the tour to India and Kashmir. You got the tour to Spain and Morocco. You got the tour to Vietnam. You got the tour to the Middle East, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon. So, yeah, call in. If some of these tours are already full, and I'm trying for more seats. But it's time for light at the end of the tunnel. You know, Donald Trump recently said, well, we've been to the moon, we have to go to Mars now. We have to go to Mars. Right? Let me just see if I missed out anything. No. Right, Donald Trump said, let's go to Mars. And I got a story already that he's been to Mars. Hmm? Did you know that? And here's the story. Donald Trump, he went to Mars. Actually, he and a monkey were put on a spaceship and they were sent into space to try to reach Mars. Before leaving Earth, each one was given an envelope and instructed to open them once they are in space. So a few hours after the takeoff, the monkey opens his envelope, and the envelope says, and the letter inside says, adjust the communication antenna, jettison fuel pods, check the antimatter reading, calibrate the oxygen ratio, ease back on the throttle controls, and reposition the heat shield panels. That was in the envelope given to the monkey. Now, Trump opens his envelope and he reads this. Feed the monkey. Right, we got 2 minutes left, so let me see if I got another one for you. Maybe a recycled one, eh? Ghulam Bhai had a very embarrassing problem. Old Bali. So he went to see Dr. Mullah in Isipingo. Doctor, I got a very bad problem. The whole day I am passing lots of gas. Every day, doctor. In your waiting room, I must have passed gas at least 20 times. But the good thing is that it makes no sound and there is no smell. But doctor, you must help me with this gas problem. Dr. Mullah gives Ghulam Bhai some pills and tells him, come back and see me next week. The next week, Ghulam Bhai goes back and tells him, hey, doc, I don't know what you gave me, but now when I pass gas, it stinks very badly. And Dr. Mullah answered, okay, Ghulam, now that we cleared up your sinuses, let's work on your hearing. Oh, this is A.B. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.